right. Rock and roll. Okay, a little bit of dramatic tension at the beginning of the talk. So hi, my name is James, and today I'm going to describe to you a system for measuring host availability in enterprise networks that contain hundreds of thousands of hosts. This is work I've done at Microsoft with my colleagues there and Brian Noble at the University of Michigan. So we all know that the internet's a very serious business. Modern enterprise networks span hundreds of thousands of hosts, they're in multiple geographic domains, and they run dozens of services that have to interface with both internal enterprise machines and external clients. So keeping these machines online and running well is extremely important for business reasons, right? Clearly, worker productivity goes up when they can access the corporate file system or the email database. Now, when these systems start to misbehave, we can ask several questions. And in this talk, we're going to look at one very simple but very important question, which is, at any given moment, how can we tell which enterprise machines are online and network reachable? Both internally, can our enterprise machines talk to each other, and externally, can they speak to other clients out in the wider internet? So let's step back for a moment and first ask ourselves, well, who could give us this availability data about our systems? Well, ideally, it might come from Zeus, but sadly, these Greek deities are not real. Now, if we were lucky, our distributed systems might measure themselves, and they often do in some way. So for example, overlay networks like Quarter Pastry send out keep alive messages to make sure that peers are online. Unfortunately, each host only tracks the availability of a small subset of peers, making it difficult to do real-time analyses over the global availability state. Now, there's some services like Comon, for example, that monitor the availability of all the Planet Lab nodes, but unfortunately, Comon isn't going to scale to the hundreds of thousands of hosts that we have in very large-scale enterprise networks. Comon also requires us to modify the end host in the system, which may be difficult in very large systems containing a lot of heterogeneity in terms of the software stack on the client side. So to address these issues, we created a new tool called StrobeLite, which provides persistent enterprise-level monitoring of networks that have hundreds of thousands of hosts. So we've been running this at Microsoft for over 2 years, and it's currently tracking the availability of the roughly 250,000 hosts that we have in our network. It issues a network-wide sweep of all the hosts once every 30 seconds, which makes it fast enough for near real-time analysis. And it also archives its results in our corporate file system, making these results available for offline analysis by the services. Importantly, StrobeLite doesn't require modification to in-host or to the core routing infrastructure. Now, what might we do with this fine-grained availability data about our hosts? Well, one thing we could do is improve the performance of our distributed systems. So for example, in a file system like Farsight, we could use this availability data to guide replication policies, duplicating an object on hosts whose downtime was likely to be uncorrelated. If we were building a multicast tree inside of the enterprise network, we could put highly available hosts at that core, avoiding expensive rebuilding operations when those nodes go away. And as I'll show later, we can also use an availability monitoring infrastructure to detect certain type of system-level anomalies, such as misconfigured routers or IP hijacking attacks. So here's an outline for the rest of the talk. First, I'm going to give you the design and implementation of StrobeLite. Then I'm going to introduce a new measurement primitive called an availability fingerprint. An availability fingerprint is an instantaneous snapshot of a subnet's availability at a point in time. And as I'll show you, these fingerprints change very slowly as time progresses. And we can take advantage of this behavior to detect certain types of anomalies in the network. I'll give one specific example about detecting certain types of IP hijacks. Then I'll give you the standard related work talk, and then we'll conclude. So there are three main design goals that motivated the creation of StrobeLite. So our first design goal was to keep it simple. We didn't want to modify the in-host in the network, and we didn't want to change anything inside of the routing core. Our second design goal was we didn't want to be annoying, okay? We didn't want to impact the real non-measurement flows in our network, okay? That was extremely important for us. And the third principle was we wanted to collect high-resolution data, okay? And this photo has nothing to do with that. It just seemed like it was entertaining to me. So we wanted to collect per-host statistics, and we also wanted to have fine temporal granularity for this data that we did collect. Now, there were also non-goals, which I've trademarked, so don't use that. So first of all, we didn't want to scale infinitely, or we didn't need to scale infinitely, right? Our target for scalability was hundreds of thousands of hosts that were in a small number of administrative domains within inside the enterprise. And because these were all inside the enterprise, we thought to ourselves, well, a centralized solution might be okay in this problem domain. We also didn't want to completely solve the problem of address disambiguation. So things like NATs and DHCP can sometimes decouple the relationship between physical machines and IP addresses. And so we were content just to measure the reachability of an IP address and remain agnostic as to what machine was lying behind that. Now, as it turns out, in our network, the binding between IPs and machines was fairly static, at least for desktop machines. So in practice, that wasn't a problem for us. So here's the winning design that we came up with. So we have a probing server here in the middle, which discovers the hosts that are in our network by getting dumps of the DNS zone files. And in the Microsoft network, this typically contains data for roughly 250,000 hosts. So every 30 seconds, that probe server is going to issue standard ping probes to all 250,000 of the hosts in the network. It's going to transfer that data to the corporate file store for longitudinal analysis and archival purposes. And it's also going to transfer that data to an analysis engine, which can perform real-time introspection and raise alarms if we see something that's kind of strange. So that's an overview of what our system is. Now let's look at how we can analyze the data that it collects using this notion of an availability fingerprint. So an availability fingerprint is simply an instantaneous snapshot of subnet availability collected during one sweep of the probe light system. It's just a bit vector where a particular bit is one only if that host responded to a probe during that particular sweep. And the similarity metric we can use to compare two different fingerprints is simply the number of equivalent bit positions. And so to abstract away the notion of subnet size, we can just normalize this number of equivalent bit positions into the range negative 1 and 1. So given this new primitive of an availability fingerprint, we can ask two questions. What does fingernet similarity look like within a single subnet across time? And also, at any given time, how do the fingerprints for two subnets compare? So to answer that first question, here I have a PDF of subnet self-similarity. And to get this graph, we step through the MSR trace, the two-year-long trace, at intervals of 15 minutes. And at every interval, we calculated each subnet's fingerprint and compared its current fingerprint to its fingerprint from the previous 15-minute interval. And so what we see is that these availability fingerprints change very little over time, right? And note that the default measurement interval of strobe light is once every 30 seconds, right? So actually, they change even less over that time period. And as I'll show you later, we can take advantage of this stability to detect certain types of misconfigurations, which manifest themselves as dramatic changes in fingerprints. So now we look at the second question. At any given time, what do two subnets' fingerprints look like with respect to each other? Now what we have here is on this axis here, we have subnet size. And then on the axis label at the bottom, that's just a PDF, once again, of cross-subnet similarity. And so what we see is that for networks or subnets, even as small as 32 hosts, most of that probability mass is in the middle, meaning that at any given time, it's very likely for two subnets to have fingerprints that are extremely similar, right? Now, you might notice if you get eagle eyes, there's some very curious behavior happening over here, these little spikes. And so what this seems to say is that there are a few subnets that seem to have very, very similar fingerprints. So what's going on here? We're scientists. We want answers to this. Well, to look at this question, we looked at cross-subnet similarity versus time. So now we've fixed, in this graph, the subnet size at 256 hosts. And so now this axis labeled on the right, that's now time. So what do we see here? Well, I split this graph into two parts. And what I call the cool part of the graph over here, we see exactly what we would expect, right? So any two subnets are likely to have, you know, sort of weakly similar or weakly dissimilar fingerprints, but none are very, very similar. Now, in what I dub the uncool part of the graph here, now we see the root of this interesting behavior here. We see this burst in subnet similarity. Now, what's causing this? Well, obviously, I first thought paranormal activity was to blame. But as it turns out, this was not the issue, at least in this case. So as it turns out, that burst in similarity was caused when two subnets in our network went offline, right? And as soon as they went offline, their fingerprints went to an all-zero state, right? And this caused that spike in subnet fingerprint similarity. And that's what these graphs show visually. There's time on the x-axis and fraction of machines online on the y-axis. And as soon as these subnets came back on again, then we get the expected behavior for fingerprint similarity. So this result suggests one way that you can use strobe light, namely to tell your network operators that they're doing something wrong, right? And so what's nice about this is that within 30 seconds, we're able to figure out, you know, which hosts are having the problem and when that problem happened. So in the paper, I talk about some more interesting results that we found in this two-year trace. I'm going to defer you to the paper for that discussion for reasons of time. So now I'm going to tell you how we can use externally deployed strobe light servers to detect some type of IP hijacks. First, let me give you a quick overview on what an IP hijack is. So we all know that the internet is a collection of autonomous systems. Each autonomous system is typically controlled by a single administrative domain. And the BGP protocol is what we use to stitch these autonomous systems together and facilitate routing across the global internet. So each autonomous system announces its prefix ownership using the BGP protocol, and it also announces the length of the routing path between it and other prefixes that it doesn't own. Unfortunately, there's no authentication of these BGP announcements. And of course, since we live in an evil, worst of all possible worlds, what an adversary can do is actually disrupt routing to a target prefix by falsely declaring, hey, that prefix belongs to me, or by saying, hey, I've got a really, really short route to that prefix. Okay. Now, because of the way the BGP updates propagate, it's kind of a stochastic process. And so as a result, some routers at any given time may not be affected by that BGP hijack. So some routers may be able to successfully send data to that target prefix. There are three basic types of IP hijacks. The first kind is a black hole attack, where the attacker simply drops all the traffic intended for that destination prefix. The second type of attack is called an imposture attack, and that's where the attacker pretends to be that target prefix and actively responds to traffic. And the third type of hijack attack is an interception attack, where the attacker may inspect or modify the traffic that's intended for the target prefix, but it eventually passes it along in the network. Now, the first two of these attacks should cause anomalies in the way that a subnet's fingerprint looks in external vantage points. And I'll give you an example of this. Here's the basic idea. So at the bottom of the picture, we have the enterprise network. And then on the sides, we have these strobe light servers that are deployed externally to the enterprise network at these topologically diverse locations. So each one of these servers does the regular strobe light probing. And in the common case, it will see that that enterprise network's fingerprint has changed very little, if at all. That's what my previous results showed you. Now let's suppose that an IP hijack takes place. So in this example, we have Khan, and he inserts himself into that left network path over there. So what's going to happen? Well, the server on the right should see that almost nothing has changed with the availability fingerprint. However, that server on the left will hopefully see a much, much different availability fingerprint. And it can then raise an alarm or launch the photon torpedo or get that little space bug out of Chekhov's ear. That Khan guy, some of you know what I'm talking about out there. So one question you might have is, well, when I deploy these servers externally, is the wide area going to distort our probes? So for example, are we going to lose a bunch of packets in the routing core, or just who knows what's going on there? Because we have seen that ghosts are real and they're out there. So to test this hypothesis, what we did is we deployed 10 strobe light servers at external locations, topologically diverse locations, and had them measure the 45 Class C subnets belonging to the University of Michigan Computer Science Department. And so what did we find? Well, this graph here shows time on the x-axis and the measured availability with respect to some of these external vantage points. So what we see is that for the most case, all of these viewpoints, they pretty much agreed. Now, if you have eagle eyes or can capture the obvious, you'll see that there's this sort of nastiness here. So what happened there? Well, we did some investigation digging around, and we found out that during this particular time period here, there was power failure in Detroit, which caused all of these routers to go down. Right? And this is like horrible, right? Because first there's the auto industry, now Detroit's being attacked by a giant Japanese thunder lizard, so things are not good in Michigan. Anyways, so what this little experiment showed us is two things. So first of all, it showed us that transmitting these probes across a wide area doesn't destroy their diagnostic utility. And second, this shows that if we have enough topologically diverse views, we could detect these black hole attacks. Because note that external view one could still talk to the University of Michigan Computer Science Network. It was only views 2 through 4 that had the problems. So now we're going to evaluate how we can do in terms of detecting a different type of IP hijack called a spectrum agility attack. So this is a very short-lived manipulation of BGP state. And in this attack, the attacker hijacks a very large /8 prefix. It sends spam or does some other type of evil from within random addresses in that IP space. Then it withdraws that fraudulent BGP advertisement a few minutes later. Now, since we don't know anything about how the attacker assigns attacker machines to these hijacked IP addresses, we'll assume that the attacker subnet has random fingerprint. And we'll evaluate that in a second. So we use simulations to figure out how well strobe light could detect such an attack. And we actually use that 2-year trace of Microsoft availability data here instead of the University of Michigan data, because the Microsoft data had many, many more IP addresses. And the spectrum attack really works best when you get this very large chunk of stolen IP space. So what we did in the simulation is we slid a window across this two-year-long MSR trace, and for each subnet X at each time point, we tested two similarities. And let me show you what I mean. So first assume that there's no attack, right? Here we see a time series for a particular subnet's fingerprint. So we slide this window, and what we do is we compare the subnet's fingerprint now to its previous fingerprint in the most recent time step. Now, if that similarity is greater than some threshold C, which we can pick, then we have a true negative, right? So strobe light would correctly say that the subnet's fingerprint now is a natural evolution of what it used to be in the previous time step. Now, if that similarity is less than that cutoff, we're going to have a false positive, because strobe light is going to say, hey, this fingerprint changed too much, something's wrong, they've got checkoff. Now let's suppose that there is an attack that takes place, at least in the simulated world. So once again, we move the window over, but now we compare the subnet's fingerprint from the previous time step to this randomly generated attacker fingerprint. Okay. So what can we figure out here? Well, we have a true positive if the similarity between that random fingerprint and the subnet's real fingerprint from the previous time step is below the cutoff, right? Because now strobe light will correctly say, aha, there's an anomaly here, you know, something's gone wrong. Now, if that similarity is greater than the threshold, this means that the attacker has eluded detection. This is going to be a false negative. So in this complicated-looking graph, I show you the results of the simulations. And this is for a C of 0.78, which is the value that minimizes false negatives. So let me explain what's going on here. So each cluster of bars represents results for a single subnet, okay? And here we see the five largest subnets in our network, and then on the very, very left, sort of a meta subnet consisting of all of the hosts in the Microsoft network. That's kind of the closest we can approximate a slash state. That's the biggest thing. So each cluster represents simulation accuracy results for a particular subnet. And each one of these bars inside of the cluster represents our detection accuracy when the attacker responds to a random I times 10% of our probes. So let me give you an example. So for example, this bar gives our detection accuracy when the attacker responds to 0% of our probes, 10% of our probes, or 20% of our probes, and et cetera, et cetera. So what we see is that result all the way on the left in the meta subnet, we have perfect detection accuracy there, right? And that's an important result because that's the closest that we can approximate this large slash 8, right? And we also see that in most of the other subnets, for all the response fractions, we have almost perfect detection accuracy there as well. Now, we do have a couple cases where accuracy is less than 100%. So what happened there? Well, we look back through our logs and we found out that during this period, there was actually a DNS failure in our corporate network, which made strobe light think that a bunch of hosts had gone offline. Right? And when that happened, an attacker could respond to a very small number of our probes and sort of fit right in with what strobe light thought was the natural view of the network. So now I'm just going to discuss some related work briefly and then conclude. So there's been a bunch of work in the academic community about monitoring network paths for latency, bandwidth, or just simple routability. A lot of these things are they're very nice, like the COMON that I mentioned before, which monitors availability and other types of local performance counters in Planet Lab systems. Unfortunately, a lot of this prior work either doesn't scale to enterprise systems that have hundreds of thousands of hosts, or it does scale to a very large level, but at the sacrifice of tracking per host statistics. They might do things like per stub network statistics, for example. And we really wanted to get individual machine data. There are some commercial monitoring tools for performing path monitoring and availability tracking, things like this. These tools typically work by doing remote logins to each of the end hosts and then reading local logs or performance counters or things like this. Now, the advantage of these tools is that they give you a much richer set of statistics, right? Now, the disadvantage is that they're more difficult to deploy, particularly in heterogeneous software setups, and they also have a slower refresh rate. Right, because this notion of remotely logging into a machine is much more heavyweight than simply issuing a ping probe and then getting the response back. So it's a trade-off. With respect to detecting IP hijacking, there's been a lot of work and a lot of research into this area. There's been some proposals to modify BGP or push cryptographic operations into the routing core. And these solutions are very robust with respect to preventing hijacks. Unfortunately, they do have, what on earth is going on here? Good grief, let's take care of this right now. I apologize, my mother would be very disappointed. Okay, so where was I? Ah, yes, so this stuff is very robust in terms of preventing IP hijacks. Unfortunately, it has deployability problems, right? As I'm sure we all know, the internet doesn't want to be upgraded, right? You know, we're going to be using TCP until the sun blows up and consumes the earth, right? So these have sort of deployability issues. So some people have countered that research and said, okay, well, let's just use passive monitoring of data. So for example, what if we look in databases of BGP information, like route views or IRR, right, and try to look for discrepancies in that data? So that's nice because you don't have to all of a sudden, you know, instrument the core routers. But now the problem is that these databases are typically only updated in the order of an hour, once every 2 hours, right? So now detection agility becomes the problem, particularly if we're looking at things like spectrum hijack attacks, which may take place over the span of a few minutes. You know, trying to detect them through a database that's updated hourly, that may be a problem. Now, the closest related work to what strobe light does is this notion of data plane fingerprints done by human mouth. So here what they do is they monitor a live BGP feed for suspicious updates, and they do this, and then once they figure out that a suspicious update has taken place, they're then going to scan that target prefix using in-map probes, IP ID probes, things like that. And then they're going to raise an alarm if the various vantage points detect inconsistent behavior. So our work differs from this in several ways. So first of all, we don't require privileged access to a live BGP feed, which makes it a little bit easier to deploy. Second, Hughes' system only sends out these fingerprint operations when it thinks that an anomaly has taken place, whereas we're continuously generating these fingerprints once every 30 seconds. And finally, several of these probes, like the IPID probes, they can take several minutes to complete, right? Our probes take only 30 seconds to complete, and actually much less than that. The only reason we let them take a full 30 seconds is if we want to spread the network load out. So we think that given the short duration of some of these hijack attacks, it's very important to be constantly issuing these probes, even if they're only used as tripwires, to initiate more heavyweight probes. So in conclusion, I've told you today about strobe light, which is an enterprise-level tool for monitoring host availability in networks that contain hundreds of thousands of hosts. It's very nice because it doesn't modify the in-host or require changes to the interior routers in the networking infrastructure. It generates real-time feeds of this data that it collects once every 30 seconds. And it also dumps that archival data out into our corporate file system so that other clients can use it if they would like. So I gave you one specific example of a strobe light client, which is the hijack detector, which uses this new notion of an availability fingerprint to find routing anomalies. This anomaly detection is fast because really all we're doing is just bitwise comparison operators on these fingerprints. And it's also accurate. And once again, we didn't need to modify the BGP protocol or push any cryptographic operations to the routers. Now, we don't claim that strobe light is the solution for everybody's network monitoring problem. We do think, however, it's a nice, cheap, and easy way to figure out, are my hosts accessible? Can they talk to each other? And, you know, am I maximizing the Web 5.0 cash flows coming into my enterprise when my machines can talk to each other? And so with that, I'd like to thank you and open it up for questions.
Hi, I'm Micah Scher at the University of Pennsylvania. So if I'm an attacker and I'm aware of strobe light, all I need to do is, if I want to do a BGP prefix or hijacking attack, is know the IP addresses of the AS that I need to take over. Is that right? So can't I just do what strobe light is doing, probe my targeted AS, learn the IP addresses, and then return all probes only to those IP addresses so that fingerprints look the same?
Right. So the question is, can't the attacker try to figure out what the fingerprints look like and then just respond to only those online machines when, you know, we're trying to figure out if there's a hijack taking place?
That's a much better way of putting it, yeah.
That's right, right. So that depends on, let's put it like this. First of all, we only have to let ping probes into our network that issue from IPs that we know about. Right, that's sort of like the first layer of defense. But now you could say, but what if the attacker tries to hijack the prefix containing one of our strobe light servers, right? So now it's kind of trying to spoof our measurement infrastructure. That's true, and that's a case with anything that tries to do sort of these data plane type fingerprints. Now, what you could have is you could have the strobe light servers not only monitor the enterprise network, but also the prefixes, the other prefixes that are issuing these probes, right, to try to prevent those spoofing attacks on the measurement infrastructure itself. But you're fundamentally right. So if somehow, you know, we can't filter out the attacker's probes at the edge of our enterprise network, or we somehow elude this hijacking attack on the prefixes belonging to the measurement infrastructure itself, you're right. Well, then we're kind of out of luck.
I just wonder if there's a way, at the risk of losing some compatibility, to bootstrap the path that these probes are taking back to the probe generators.
So let's see. So what do you mean by bootstrap the?
So let me think about this for a second. If you have the return path that the probe takes, that the echo takes, mm-hmm. then the probe generators can determine where the responses are actually coming from, and kind of more traditional BGP attack detection techniques.
Right, right. So we did think a little bit about things like that. I mean, unfortunately, so some of these things depend on features that might not be supported by all routers, like the ability to support some of these reverse path type statistics. We also thought about what if we put, maybe nonces in the probe pack and stuff like that. I mean, ultimately, we sort of erred on the side of that first design principle, which is to keep things simple. And so, it's always an arms race. I think that if you really want sort of the most robust protection from some of these hijacking attacks, you do need some of those, cryptographically oriented protocols that I described earlier. We're definitely sort of thinking about that in the back of our head. Like, can we do something better than just sending out ping probes and getting the responses?
Yeah, a related question on the attack assumptions. I mean, did you try to characterize what kind of attackers you definitely handle?
What type of attackers?
I mean, what kind of attack, what kind of power you can, that the attacker has that you can handle with your probing system? I mean, you talk about like hijacking attacks, mm-hmm. and I mean, it can be a distributed hijacking or other, I mean, the attacker can have potentially different powers that you can assume, or some con, like you mentioned, just random attack. So,
right.
I mean, did you try to characterize, well, if this is the attacker, we definitely handle it?
So the IP hijacks are really the only malicious activity that we looked at in any detail.
But even there, I mean, depending on what you give the attacker knowledge about the network or system.
Sure. So, I mean, at one level, the sort of most powerful thing you give the attacker is the ability to sort of duplicate our availability probes, right? That's sort mm-hmm. of the, right? Because once the attacker can do that, then we're kind of powerless, right? We have looked at some things like let's say we wanted to prevent that third type of attack, which is the interception attack, mm-hmm. right? I didn't say anything about how we could do that. Well, one thing you might think about doing is actually looking at the TTLs in the probes that strobe light comes out, because one would think that given the way that the internet's set up, that an interception attack should almost always increase the length between some vantage point and that in the destination network, right? Because presumably it's coming here, it's going to the attacker, and then getting forwarded this way. So one thing we thought about, well, maybe you could look at the TTLs in the probes and choose them in a special way so that they would time out if they didn't get to the target destination, all this type of stuff. There, if the attacker has excellent knowledge of the topology, well, then he can sort of fudge the TTLs in a certain way, which eludes that scheme. But that's sort of the extent of those types of analyses we've looked at.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.